come together.
Thanks for listening to the KC Morning Show.
This is The Negro Speaks of Rivers, one of my earliest poems written in 1920, just after I came out of high school. The way this poem came to be written was that I was going to Mexico to visit my father, who lived in Mexico City, and on the train going across the Mississippi River, just outside St. Louis, I looked out the window and I saw this great muddy river flowing down toward the heart of the South, and I began to think about what this river meant to the Negro people, how, in a sense, our history was linked to this river, how in slavery time, my grandmother told me that to be sold down the Mississippi was one of the worst things that could happen to a Negro slave. And then I remembered that I'd read about Abraham Lincoln going down the Mississippi as a young man, and he went on a raft to New Orleans, and he saw human beings bought and sold in the slave market there, and he was so horrified by this that he never forgot it. And many years later, of course, we know that it was Lincoln who signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And so, as the train went on into the gathering dusk, because it had been about sunset when we crossed the river, I took my father's letter out of my pocket and began to write down on the back of his letter this poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
Yow! What's the word? Kansas City. My name's Hartzell. A happy Tuesday to the KC Morning. Oh, Tuesdays on this show, y'all know what we do. We take back America, reclaiming that radical, progressive history of America. Myself, Professor Harvey J.K., the Professor Emeritus over at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. On the show today, the good professor, Harvey K. He is joined by Alan Minsky, who is the executive director for Progressive Democrats of America, and I guess technically my boss. I am a part of the steering committee for YPDA, Young Progressive Democrats of America. Alan and Professor K, they made an appearance on The Majority Report with Sam Cedar and Emma Viglin. One of my favorite shows. Got a chance to actually meet Emma back in 2018. She came and did a little mini documentary on the Brent Welder campaign. He took on Sharice Davids back in the day. She's incredible. I love this show. Sam Cedar, Emma Viglin, Matt Leck also as well. We talk in the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights. Y'all know that, you know, that's kind of our thing on this show. So on the show today, the good professor, Alan Minsky, and The Majority Report right here. Yes, right here on your KC Morning Show. Rate, review, subscribe, do that thing that you do. Do it. My name is Hartzell. Back in your feeds tomorrow. We will see you in the morning. Bye.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
The KC Morning Show.
On January 11, 1970, victory belonged to Hank Stram and his Kansas City Chiefs.
TV9 News Special Report.
close up the flood of 77.
From the Kemper Arena in Kansas City, Missouri, it's Milwaukee Bucks against the Kansas City Kings.
Now Kansas Citians must decide what happens next. What is to follow the city's Holy Week riots?
I am here at the American Royal World Series of Barbecue.
Daryl Motley awaits, and the Kansas City Royals are world champions. Kansas City.
Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Harvey Kay, Professor Emeritus of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. And welcome Alan Minsky, Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America, on their call and their enumeration of a 21st century economic bill of rights. Guys, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Harvey, let's start with you. Where are we in terms of straying from the concept of an economic bill of rights, or maybe better yet, let me put it, where did this first develop, this idea?
Okay. This idea was first proposed by Franklin Roosevelt. It's best known for having been the centerpiece of his 1944 State of the Union address to Congress and the nation. But the important point before I mention what he did is that in 1943, FDR wanted to know what Americans wanted after the war when it came to social policies. And he had already laid out back in 1932, when he was running for president, the idea of an economic declaration of rights. And in 1941, in a State of the Union, he had projected a vision of the four freedoms: freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. He now commissioned a major national survey, secretly, you might say, to find out what did Americans want. And what he discovered, among the things he discovered, is that 85% of Americans wanted what we would call universal health care, a guarantee of health care. They wanted comfortable housing assured. They wanted jobs with living wages. And this was just selected items of a long list of questions that they were asked. And he felt confident at the outset of 44, which was not only the time for the State of the Union address, but it was also in some ways the launching of his fourth campaign for the presidency. And in that State of the Union message, he said, "We've reached a point in American history where we've come to accept basically the idea, the necessity of a second Bill of Rights." In fact, he said, "Look, we know that needy men," and we would add women, "needy men are not free men." And he laid out a series of what he considered to be essential new rights to be recognized in a fashion, whether by way of amendment or by way of congressional action, that would literally sort of take America from the war effort into a whole new peacetime effort and would remain, he believed, intact. And if you think about it like that, that was a great vision, though probably he knew he couldn't get it too quickly, because between the Republicans in Congress aligned with the Southern Democrats, who, by the way, were not opposed to the concept, but they were afraid it might represent an undermining of segregation and white supremacy in the South. So he knew he might face opposition. Well, after the war, Truman did make certain efforts in that direction. But the idea of an economic bill of rights, although it never really was enacted, at least not aggressively so in part until things did begin to happen in the 60s, was actually the framework, very explicitly the framework, for the 1960 Democratic Party platform, the authors of which actually were worried Kennedy was not liberal enough to accept it, because he actually used to say, "I'm not a liberal," you know. And then in 1965-66, all the more enthused by the Great Society of War and Poverty efforts, A. Philip Randolph, the great labor and civil rights leader, projected the idea of a freedom budget. Not the idea, he actually laid out in a pamphlet, and I forgot we're going to be visual today. I'll just show you. This was the pamphlet itself, a freedom budget for all Americans. And it was a call, literally a call, to wipe out poverty in America, and laid out a whole series of initiatives and what it would cost. And I will tell you, 150 university presidents, foundation heads, labor leaders, practically every prominent figure in the sort of center left to the left endorsed it, though all the names are indicated in the pamphlet. And this was his call. But of course, we know all too well, tragically, the war in Vietnam literally drained away the resources that might have driven LBJ to take that war on poverty all the further. And then finally, in terms of the 60s, Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, not long before his assassination, published a piece in one of the major American magazines of the day, a call for an economic bill of rights. At that point, it generally speaking was on the agenda given what had become the Democratic Party agenda in the 60s, but it did not, in the course of the 70s, advance, period. What they saw in this, of course, was Medicare, Medicaid, and a series of things in the 60s. And it was revived, however, by Bernie Sanders in his 2019-2020 campaign on the website. Though, unfortunately, he did not take it into the presidential debates, or for that matter, into his campaign generally.
All right. Well, I want to get back to why, you know, why that didn't happen. But let's jump to Alan. Tell us what is in the 21st century economic bill of rights? I mean, you have 10, like, sort of, I guess, fundamental elements or rights that would be enumerated.
Well, we just today put up a web page on the PDA website, which is pdamerica.org/economic bill of rights with no spaces in between. So pdamerica.org/economic bill of rights. Do you want me to go through and read them?
I mean, we'll put a link to this, but let's go through them and enumerate them. And of course, this is both a messaging document and a material document, right? I mean, in both respects. I mean, it is both good policy and good politics. Read them off for us.
Sure thing. Just to say quickly, we wrote three articles, and in the second article, for each one of these, all 10 that I'm about to read, we match them up with really existing legislation in the contemporary Congress that basically puts forward this. In other words, we're making the point that the Bernie Sanders squad, left progressive wing of the Democratic Party, already supports this. So it's a messaging thing to accent the fact that emphasizing economics is a very important thing that the progressive Democrats, broadly understood, need to do more in terms of this election cycle and all election cycles going forward, and at least in the near future. So here they are. A 21st century economic bill of rights will guarantee all people residing in the United States the right to the essentials of a good life, regardless of their income, race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or country of origins. So the 10 items are: 1, a useful job that pays a living wage. 2, a voice in the workplace through a union and collective bargaining. 3, comprehensive quality health care. 4, complete cost-free public education and access to broadband internet. 5, decent, safe, affordable housing. And remember, these are all we're saying should be guaranteed rights in society. 6, a clean environment and a healthy planet. 7, a meaningful endowment of resources at birth and a secure retirement, so youth and early life and end of life. 8, sound banking and financial services. 9, an equitable and economically fair justice system. 10, recreation and participation in civic and democratic life. The word recreation, by the way, is one thing that we kept as a word itself from the Roosevelt era. You can look at that line and say the right to guaranteed paid vacation. So 10 is recreation and participation in civic and democratic life. So those are the 10, with number 1 at the top again, a useful job that pays a living wage.
My name's Hartzell. When we come back, more from Professor Harvey K., Alan Minsky, the executive director over at Progressive Democrats of America, and Sam Cedar and Emma Biglin, host of The Majority Report. This is awesome. My name's Hartzell. This is your KC Morning Show. It doesn't hurt me.
Yeah.
I'm interested, Alan, and Harvey, you can weigh in on this too. The use of the concept of freedom as a linchpin for FDR, and sort of the abandonment of it, it seems to me, in the, you know, both as a rhetorical device, but also as a concept that because so much of what we by the left, by the, you know, the center left, by the Democrats, progressives, however you want to say it, that libertarians sort of and conservatives sort of took over, hijacked the concept of freedom or liberty, and have redefined it as something where they are unencumbered by any type of action by government that promotes these values, as opposed to an individual's freedom or liberty from the that government can actually provide for them in against sort of the idea of need or economic coercion or outside threats.
Harvey, why don't you take that? But let me just say, I am just doing big cheerleading for your leading question, Sam, because it's right on point. Take it away, Harvey.
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, as long as we've got the idea of messaging in our heads, I mean, FDR, whatever his faults and failings were, was an absolutely brilliant messenger. And he always rooted whatever he did in this idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that was the fundamental American promise, which is why when he first envisioned something like this Economic Bill of Rights, he talked about an economic declaration of rights. He said, you know, in the course of the 19th century and the Gilded Age, we've allowed the titans of industry, in other words, the big industrial capitalists, to hijack the American promise. And it's time we take back and renew that promise. But to do that, we need to remember that even then, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was a signal that economic security, that economic opportunity were fundamental to that American promise. And so really, whenever he spoke, he always tried to root it fundamentally in that revolutionary moment of 1776. Now, I mean, my thinking is that, yeah, that we've kind of lost touch with that. And by the way, if you were to read, say, The Nation, you'd probably see the word rights along the way. And if you read The National Review, you'd see the word liberty regularly along the way. And that was what FDR may well have feared, the possibility that indeed, because he warned at the end of his State of the Union address, he said, beware of rightist reaction. And he didn't mean the likes of those who stormed on January 6th, the Capitol. He actually meant the corporate bosses. As he said, it was a wealthy business figure who told him, be careful about the right-wing reactionary corporate interests coming after this. So, I mean, I hope I'm getting to the point, and that is that the question of rights is freedom and liberty in FDR's mind. And what we need to remember is that we've allowed a certain language, I hate to use a postmodern term, discourse, to be hijacked truly by the right. And in fact, I think all too often, and this is my view at least, all too often we've generally allowed the right ever since Ronald Reagan to do a massive hijacking of the American story and the American imagination.
Well, frankly, I feel that, you know, without a coordinated offensive, right, like the one that you're advocating for, where it's a broad policy set that includes rights for all Americans, economic rights. And I think the theme of the show today is Democratic leadership failures. And it's just these tweaks to the system. You're ceding the framing to the right wing in the way that you describe, Harvey. So there's a absence of imagination that I think is inherent to this, and they wouldn't even entertain these concepts, frankly.
Yeah, well, Alan might well mention that the candidates, at least that his organization, Progressive Democrats, have embraced and endorsed, have themselves been asked whether they could take this on as part of their mission. And I'll just, before we get into that, I'll just say that my greatest hope was that Nina Turner was going to win in Cleveland, because she was so enthusiastic about this. And I thought she would be, excuse the metaphor, the vehicle to take this into the Progressive Caucus, or at least into the squad. The word rejuvenate is improper because they're all much younger than I am, but to revive the energies that we saw at the outset of their formation. Right, Alan? Yeah, I'll leave that to you.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really sort of crazy that the progressive movement writ large doesn't lead more with economics. I mean, simply put, and for decades, and currently at this moment with inflationary concerns, economics is polling as the top concern for the American public. Okay, right there, you have to speak to the electorate. Okay, the left progressive movement has allowed itself to be defined by basically jerks like Bill Maher as being all about, you know, messaging that suffocates public discourse, okay? Or whatever issue of the day they want to highlight as what the left progressives are about. You actually look at the work of the actual progressives in Congress, in this Congress, last year, and what they were focused on, just absolutely laser focused on, was making all of the statutes in Build Back Better more economically progressive. You know, the center right would say, no, this goes too far. They would take it another direction. They'd even propose something better. So the actual work they were doing was on core economics. And really, if we had a unified left progressive movement, which we need to have because we're looking at the absence of a leading progressive presidential candidate for 2024. And we really need to have coordination where economic messaging is at the really front and center of what we stand for, because these are incredibly popular positions when you fill in the public policy positions for all 10 of those points. I mean, you look at the polling among Democrats, registered Democrats, and it's an astronomical blowout that we should be winning all of these elections. Now we know incumbency, the power of incumbency, the power of money, and all that that can do to pollute the airwaves in these small congressional districts can really skew the results. And that's what we're seeing across the country. We had a victory against massive amounts of money in Pennsylvania. But my word, you know, these are difficult. Buying congressional races is an easy thing to do in the era of Citizens United. So how do we face that? We face that with basically run a national unified messaging campaign as best as possible. I mean, it's going to have some fluctuations here and there. But if you lead with economics on that, and by the way, this in no way abandons any of the other issues. By all measures, the progressive movement is going to be the greatest ally for the transgendered movement, for all of the issues that otherwise are being spoken about. But this needs to come up as really the top central focus of the issue of the progressive left. One, because it's a winning hand. No, two, because it was a winning hand. And one, because it's already the work that we stand for. It's the most difficult lift because, let's face it, American big money, American capital, in all of its power and force, is going to be arrayed against this message in ways that they're not going to be against other messages. So.
What is the mechanism for that? I mean, because we do have, right, like, you know, I mean, look, Nina Turner was outspent, in terms of this outside money, it came in hard, and we watch Cisneros have to, you know, she sort of tempered her message a little bit, I think, for a changing district. But again, there were, you know, incumbency forces and the Democratic leadership and, you know, NRA and that weigh in on this. They're not going away, right? I mean, those things exist. What is the mechanism? And I accept the premise that there needs to be a sort of like a 20,000, 30,000 foot type of narrative that stretches, that provides its own sort of umbrella for, and this is that message. But what's the apparatus that gets everyone on the same page, that carries that message, so that when Nina Turner or Summer Lee was able to pull it off in Pennsylvania, but if you want to increase the sort of percentage of success, I guess, what is the apparatus that provides at least the context for those races to happen and give them a slight leg up on day one? I mean, does anybody have a number? Like, I mean, look, you know, we watched the Freedom Caucus, and we never knew how many people were in the Freedom Caucus. That was one of their sort of like their features. We're not going to, you know, it's like Fight Club type of thing. And I'm not exactly sure what the value of that was, other than they could probably project you know, they didn't have defections because nobody knew whether or not the people were in there anyways. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see the value of it on some level, and it's certainly consistent with the brand in terms of lack of transparency. But did someone have a number?
Well, the things we're proposing, you know how absurd the historical moment is? And of course, this is an incredibly complex question. But if you look at America's top allies around the world, throughout the whole Cold War period, we know which countries they were: Western Europe, South Korea, Japan. I mean, some of them because of conquest and all that. But basically, they all have this economic contract, social contract, and we don't. And the even more of a craziness about it is, of course, the Roosevelt and Truman administration actually went in and drafted a lot of these constitutions that guaranteed the existence of social democracy. Now, neoliberalism has chipped away at it, but look, not really. They all have free universal health care. They largely have all free public education through higher education. That even just got expanded in Germany under Angela Merkel. So we're the one country doesn't have it. This is not a utopian scheme that's impossible to imagine how it would be operating, right?
You know, if we had 65 people, maybe it's 75, maybe it's 50. I don't know. Would be able to leverage this in this way. I mean, because if it's 218... I want to be at least, I want to have some, you know, at least descendants that will. Yeah.
Well, first of all, the first step under 218, if you just want to do it simply, would be half of that plus one. Once it becomes the majority of the caucus, then clearly the Democratic Party is standing for these things. It's out in front of the public in a way that is very clear. Now, under Jayapal's leadership and Pocan too, on these matters, public facing, they would advocate for this. They would call for this. I mean, they were both brave enough to support Bernie Sanders for president in 2020. And so, you know, you start getting up towards 120. Okay, let's say we have to get to where the Progressive Caucus has a stronger hand in advocating for that. Again, probably cut in half plus one. So, you know, you're getting down to just a quarter of the Congress being really, really solid, but bold advocates for this. They do need to be bold advocates, because within the range of about the 20 to 70 that we have, many of them aren't. Now, it's difficult to get that much press and focus on you, as you know very well, if you're just one of the Congress people. But again, once we get the Progressive Caucus, as it's been built up, Jayapal's done an incredible job organizing.
You know. What about in the Senate? I mean, because, you know, to the extent that these things would have passed if there wasn't an awareness that the Senate was going to kill it anyways, we might have had different votes. But what about in the Senate?
Okay, well, of course, you're getting to what is the best shot at achieving this quickly, which is to the executive branch in a race nationally, because these issues are very popular. In the Senate right now, we maybe have like 3 to 7 people who really consistently stand with this agenda. So, yes, slow moving in the Senate, and that goes to how expensive Senate races are. But again, the presidency, the most expensive is the race, of course, that more Americans pay attention to, and we saw a tremendous performance there in terms of the popularity of these issues on the national stage. On Senate races, in many respects, those are the hardest lift, because the cost of Senate races can be prohibitive for where the money is on the progressive left, and because of the Citizens United, and we can compete more at the House level. But, you know, again, we got to get involved state by state and start getting these champions onto the Senate ticket and not shy away from that and build up the movement. I do think, even with some mixed results, we are the political movement with as much momentum as any political movement within electoral politics in the country.
Harvey, let me ask you, I guess, a more conceptual question, too, to get back to those ideas. You cite the Declaration of Independence and FDR's Four Freedoms. Why not the Constitution? I interviewed some folks, it was a pre-record, but William Forbath and Joseph Fishkin, law professors, and they've just come out with a book, The Anti-Oligarchy Constitution. Subtitle: Reconstructing the Economic Foundations of Democracy. But the idea being that the Constitution was a document that was fundamentally, even if you accept the frame of the right to some extent, that it is a document that inhibits the federal government's ability to, you know, constrain the states or individuals. That is a statement against consolidated, concentrated power in and of itself, right? I mean, because, you know, when the Constitution is written, they're talking about, they don't want a king. And what is a king if not Bill Gates, right? Someone who has an incredible concentration of wealth that they can deploy to change the course of a country or of a society. And, you know, at that time, the only Bill Gates is around at that time wore crowns for the most part. And so this is a document that is written to constrain consolidated power. And it vests the power in we the people, which suggests that that power and wealth should be distributed amongst we the people. And so why not also, you know, if we're getting back to the idea of like, we need a broad framework and need to recapture the narrative, captured by the right of these founding documents and these concepts, why not also let's take back the Constitution too?
That's great. We do know that it's almost impossible to get amendments passed, but we do know that the preamble to the Constitution.
Do we need them?
Quite possibly no. But this is a question also, you know, as you were saying that, and I'm intending to read Forbath's book. I go back to FDR, and I will say that in 1936, when he was going to run once again for president, when he accepted the nomination, and the entire platform at that point was laid out in terms of the Declaration of Independence, he went before the stadium audience and he warned of economic royalists. He grabbed hold of that original idea. You mentioned aristocracy. He said, you know what? We fought a revolution and we set up a country in order not to have political royalists. He said, today, the economic royalists say that we want to overthrow American institutions. And maybe you know the next line. He said, well, they're right about one thing. We want to overthrow something. We want to overthrow their power. Wouldn't you love to hear? Wouldn't you love? I mean, by the way, Bernie Sanders might have taken that next step if he was more aggressive about grabbing hold of the past than he was. But it is the case that that kind of language would definitely resonate among Americans. I could easily imagine a candidate running simply in terms of the preamble to the Constitution and the Commonwealth, the common welfare. I mean, those are the kinds of things. It's not simply a language. It's also the idea that, look, to my mind, the Democrats have literally turned their back on the progressive and radical story of America over and over again. And by the way, that I include in that even the progressives. Okay. And the fact is that the American imagination is waiting to be, if you like, redeemed and tapped. The greatest, look, not the greatest. I mean, in one sense, it's the greatest in the Voldemort sense. Roosevelt was the history teacher in chief. Ronald Reagan worshipped FDR's memory, turned it inside out. But he knew that if you're going to transform, you also have to tell a story, not merely offer an agenda. And in part, this proposal that we've made is an effort not only to lay out 10 rights, economic rights, it's also the idea of starting to take back that story and cultivating the story for the 21st century. I mean, I have no argument with taking hold of the Constitution. I think the 14th Amendment should have been used far more often than it has been.
You're not necessarily even taking back a story. You are tapping into a pre-existing, almost primal narrative that exists amongst the American public.
Absolutely.
And it is much easier, something that there's already a foundation, where there's already an understanding, and that it's almost an inarticulated understanding of the way that the country should be. And tapping into that makes it a lot easier. You're suddenly going with the flow of the river of our history, I guess. But Harvey K., Alan Minsky, thank you so much for this. We will put a link to all the URLs you mentioned, and to this economic Bill of Rights. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both.
I appreciate all your work.
It's good to see you all.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
I've been traveling, but I don't know where. I've been missing you, but you just don't care. And I've been wondering, I see Greece around, lost in the wilderness, so far from down. Soul. And I feel like an actor looking for a role. I've been in Arabia, I've seen a million stars. Been sipping champagne on the boulevard.
Be my